The big six power companies have confirmed that they're putting up prices from next month. Millions of Npower and British Gas customers will be affected. Average Npower customers are likely to see their bills rise by more than £100 a year. Richard Lloyd from Consumer Group Which says it's going to hit those who are already struggling.
6 million people saying they're going to have to do less to keep their house warm and making tough choices about how they spend their household budgets this winter. There's a fundamental problem here of affordability of energy at a time when household budgets are most under pressure.
The police watchdog has ordered its largest ever investigation into allegations of a cover-up over the Hillsborough disaster. It says it will look into the actions of many current and former officers and could pursue criminal charges. TV actress Julie Fernandez says she was groped by Jimmy Savile when she appeared on Jim'll Fix It at the age of 14. The disabled star, who appeared in the sitcom The Office, says his hands lingered in places they shouldn't. Some O2 customers have once again experienced problems with their mobile phone services. The company says approximately 10% of its 23 million customers have experienced intermittent service when making calls or using data since lunchtime. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Stoke Bishop Peter Abraham. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour after six, Big Brother watcher Steve Jolly has been at the Tory party conference this week to meet some of the movers and shakers and possibly the profiteers in the CCTV world, asking whether there's any proper oversight of this increasingly privatised industry of snoopers. And the BBC 7-7 conspiracy road trip aired on BBC Three last week. We talked to one of the participants and asked, was the programme a conspiracy in itself? Plus, further developments with the bus rapid transit system here in Bristol. We get the latest from BCFM's transport campaigner, Steve Satan. And, as ever, Martin Summers takes a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 13, sunny on Saturday, with sunny spells on Sunday. Looks as if we've got a rain-free weekend from now on, let's hope. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, a fairly sunny week with some possible showers midweek. Next weekend, 20th and 21st of October, highs of 16 Celsius, fairly cloudy with some showers and windy. That's not so good, is it, next weekend? That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Stoke Bishop Peter Abraham. Hi, Peter. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, you're not just a Conservative Councillor, are you? Because you have quite a big role in the Conservative group as well on the City Council.
I am the leader, yes.
Okay, yes. And what does it mean to be a leader? I mean, what do you actually do? Are you just tell everyone what to do? And how also, I suppose I should ask, do you actually get elected as a leader?
Yes, we get elected as a leader every year. And I don't know about telling everybody what to do, but it just means that you get on as a leader of any group or party does. It could be the chairman, but it means you also play a major role within the council, because the leaders will have meetings and make certain decisions, particularly in a council like Bristol that has no overall control.
Now, how does it work here in the City Council? Is it a bit like Westminster, where you've got whips, where you say, well, look, actually, this is the party line, and you tell or ask or maybe arm twist a little bit the councillors to go along with that?
We have a whip, Chief Whip, John Galandris, and my style is it tends not to be to order or cajole. We come to a decision democratically, and then for the good of the city, we try and stick to that. Over the years, I've found that to have so many diverse views is impossible. So we try to come together, and that means compromise.
Now, you mentioned John. He shares the Stoke Bishop ward with you.
That's
as a
right.
Conservative councillor.
Coincidence.
He's a bit of an elusive chap. He doesn't return my phone calls. He doesn't reply to my emails. And he is actually working, isn't he, pretty much full-time for Coutts Bank at the moment. I mean, he's not as if he's an ex-banker. I mean, why is it, do you think, that, you know... I mean, I find it a bit difficult when I'm inviting people on here, for example, phoning them, and I don't get a reply from a councillor. It bothers me.
I'm absolutely shocked, is that, because I would say that John is one of my most reliable at replying. So something's going wrong there. But let's... the more serious thing you're saying is about he's working. That's what a councillor does.
As a banker, no, well, he's working for Coutts Bank, which is the Queen's Bank, isn't it?
Well, he works for... the Bank of Scotland, which is owned by us. So I tease him all the time that in actual fact, he's a civil servant. He works for you and I, and we pay his wages. He'll kill me for saying this, but he is, he does something within Coutts. They've got a Bristol branch, but I think he works a little bit wider than Bristol. Very intelligent, nice guy.
Well, we'll see if next time you see him, if you can twist his arm and say, get on the politics show.
Yeah, maybe 5 o'clock on a Friday night is a very difficult. They're probably making sure they're balancing the Queen's cash or something at this time of night on a Friday.
Okay, your candidate for mayor is Jeff Gollop, who was
correct.
Also leader recently, I think probably just before you. Give us an idea of what the Conservative vision for the city is going into these mayoral elections.
Well, I think it's to understand the role of the mayor to start with. I'm hearing so much that is so wide of the mark.
Well, it sounds to me like you're talking about crash testing it before it's actually happened. You know,
understand what you mean by
well,
that.
Well, I mean, the idea being that you're not really sure what the mayor is going to be able to
I'm
do.
I'm very, very sure.
Okay.
The mayor, and I'm sure because the referendum, I think, was very clear. It said, do you want the leader of the council to continue to be elected by the councillors? Or do you want the leader of council to be elected by you, which we'll call a mayor? Now, that is what the job's going to be. It's going to be the leader of council. I see something in front of me that's not quite accurate about what we'll be talking about later. The mayor will make the decision. No, the council will still make many of the decisions and will be able to change many of the decisions. What I see the mayor, to come back to your proper and serious question doing, is giving leadership in the city and not just being the mayor of College Green, but the mayor across the whole of the city. I think there's this feeling that the leader of council, by that nature, runs the council. I want somebody to give some leadership to the community, to business, right across. And I hope that we'll have a mayor that will be able to do that. And I think Jeff Gollop is well suited for that post.
Now, you did say there was a sort of you believe there was an endorsement for the mayor, but the thing is that the actual number of people that voted was very, very small, wasn't it?
Most
people didn't even take part in that vote. Now, if this was a union ballot, you know, you would probably be saying, oh well, at British Airways or somewhere, you'd say, well, not very many people voted for this. We shouldn't be doing it.
I didn't make the rules. I would have had. Personally, would have wanted a substantial majority, because I think that I think there should be. What I want is somebody that we all support in the city, and I think it's rather sad that so many people didn't bother. Because when I go in the pub, they're all having a go. They all want to say, "Well, we should be doing this. The council's wrong in doing that." That was their opportunity. 10 minutes. Not even that if they got a postal vote and they didn't bother. So I think we've got a job to do to say to people, come on, if you really want the city to be run well, you've got a role to play as well.
And in fact, it may even be less people participating in the vote for Police and Crime Commissioner, which is happening at the same time as mayor. I mean, that
could be derisory.
Yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts about the change from the police authority, which is a broad spread of people, which are from different geographical areas, some are not politicians, some are lay members, to just simply one person really telling the Avon and Somerset Police what their priorities must be?
I support it, actually. I support it because, do you know, I can't, and I'm somebody involved, I can't tell you who the chairman of the police authority is, can you?
No. We've had Doug Naismith on here, for example, who's discussed it.
But he's not the chairman of the police authority. I think, and I might have met them, I don't know, they don't come along to College Green and talk to us about policing. I tell you, I think that by this time next year, we would have been talking to the police commissioner, saying what our community needs are. So I think this is somebody the public, again, like the mayor, can identify with. I hope that a lot of people, particularly those that were interested, will know that person's name and know how to get in touch with them.
Isn't it partly, Peter, because the meetings of the police authority take place, you know, miles away from Bristol, up at the castle up on in Portishead, on top of the hill, and not somewhere like in somewhere in the city centre or in the council house, where it would be much more accessible.
The whole
much
of the Old Avon area in Somerset.
Yes, but
you'd be very upset if you lived in Nemthet Thrubwell and you have your meeting in the centre of Bristol.
Not necessarily, because it's actually easier to get by public transport, for example, to Bristol and back to Nemthet Thrubwell than it is to the top of a hill in Portishead.
Next time I'm down in the wilds of Somerset and I say that all your meetings should be held in Bristol, because I agree with you. I think Bristol is the capital of this West Country and we should be stating our case. But it done half upset people.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, we've had the Conservative Party conference this week, and we had a bit of a strange thing halfway through the week where the IMF announced that they were downgrading Britain's future credit worthiness. At the same time, we had David Cameron announcing that everything was healthy with the economy here.
Well, I think we crossed the Rubicon not long ago when it became clear that the government's timetable for reducing the deficit was slipping and that the economy was starting to go south, so that we've actually reached the point predicted by people like myself where the further imposition of austerity will actually lead to further problems with the deficit, and the IMF are belatedly recognising that reality. I'm not taking any pleasure in this, because it's actually where we don't want to be, but I'm afraid we are now on the slippery slope, which Ireland, Greece, Spain, Portugal have already fallen down. And the problem with when you get to this point is that further austerity does not lead to reductions in deficits. It actually leads to a situation where the deficit can explode out of control because of the problems with the way the system works. I don't think there's any easy solution. I wish there was, but I'm afraid that's where we are.
Well, national debt is going up, Peter. This is one of the big problems, isn't it? When we were, the Conservatives and Liberal Democrat coalition was formed at the election in 2010, we had a $760 billion national debt. This year, we passed the threshold of $1,000 billion, which is $1 trillion, and we're now looking at, in 2015, the current projections are $1.36 trillion debt. So, I mean, basically, we've got a 45-degree uphill curve we're looking at with the actual national debt. So, what seems to be going on is that the cuts are biting into the economy to such an extent that there's less and less money the government's getting in tax to pay off that debt, and we could be in danger of what Martin said there, is going down the road of Spain and Greece and getting into a death spiral of debt where we could never pay it off.
I think it's a total exaggeration to say we're going down the spiral of Greece or Spain. I think that in time Greece will come out of the euro, and they represent about 1.5% of it, so I don't think it'll mean a great deal. I think that the worry must be Spain, but I don't think that that is a problem that we have at this time. But you said that everything was healthy with the economy was the Conservative message. I didn't go, but I was listening to news. I didn't hear that. I heard some real warnings. And my worry is that I'm not sure that some people are totally convinced of where we are. And I think we are in a dangerously situation. And I genuinely believe that you have to make every effort to cut down the expenditure of government. We are spending too much, and if the debt is going up, one could argue, well, that is some expenditure taking place. I think that when I go around this city, which is my interest, there seems to be lots of people where the recession is not really hitting in quite the same way as others. And I think you have to start looking at the families to see where there's real problems. And I think those problems are going to increase. So I hope that the Chancellor will stick the course, will reduce the debt. But I think what we've got to do is try to put in and use this time, rather than unemployment pay, but to really start investing some of the infrastructure within the country. This could be the time where we could start to rebuild so much, which is still bad. You know, particularly when you go around this city and other cities, things need to be done. So I would like to see us really invest in community and investment, but at the same time, cut the government expenditure down. I'm sure there's too much waste. And that means jobs in the public sector. I mean, I think civil servants are at risk in my plan.
A couple more figures I've pulled together this week. The first lot you heard about the national debt was from Dominic Laurie on Five Live. Another one is the housing benefit bill. This is going through the roof, quite literally, of the House. In 2010, when you formed the coalition, Peter, the Conservatives, it was $16 billion annual budget. Now it's, in 2012, it's $21.6 billion annual budget. This is another one of those 45 degree curves on the graph that's just going up and up. We've also seen buy-to-let people doing very, very well out of all this. This is people who've got so much money they can buy a second house and let it out. Yields from buy-to-let are going up in the last year from 6.1% of their investment. People are now getting 6.7% return on their investment in a house that they don't actually live in themselves. So letting out, being a landlord, is becoming very much more lucrative.
But when did they get that buy-to-let? Not at the moment. It's not easy to get the buy-to-let mortgages. They got those under Labour that allowed the whole thing to get out of control. I think you've got to be balanced about this. And I know people 10 years ago that were selling buy-to-let, going out saying, buy this property, then you can buy another. This was all under Labour, who lost control. We've inherited this, whether you like it or not. Nobody likes it. But we're living with the pains of where the economy was not controlled at the level it should have been done.
Martin, what about these figures here? Because a lot of this housing benefit money is actually going to, not to people who are claiming it, but the people who own these places. And maybe this is partly why we've seen such a big hike in the amount of money that return, basically, on their investment, that people who are buying homes that they don't live in to let out are getting.
Well, I think well, everybody here has agreed that there's a problem with this, and of course it was under Labour that this was allowed to happen, and you won't hear me criticising Peter for saying that. I think what we've actually had is the financial sector, after it was deregulated in the 1980s, have been allowed to get away with murder, frankly, and they're still getting away with murder. Absolutely. The reason why we've got a huge deficit is because we bailed out the banking system.
The point here being that
fundamentally, the City of London has been bailed out, and if you were to follow a free market policy as put forward by the von Mises Institute, for example, we wouldn't have bailed the banks out. Wouldn't have bailed them out at all.
The point here, you have to
face a stock market crash and the loss of massive amounts of capital for the wealthy classes.
The point here
being,
that's
a free market policy,
Martin. That actually, it's not the, it, it's the rich are doing quite well out of this. If you've got enough money to buy several houses that you don't need to live in, then you lend that out. You're doing very nicely at the moment.
Well, quantitative easing also increases asset values, so those who have assets are doing very well out of the crisis, which is why, of course, they're rather blasé about the level of the crisis. The fact of the matter is, cutting government expenditure in a situation like this, previous Conservative governments in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s would never have cut public expenditure at this moment. It's a foolish thing to do. It's like putting the brake on the car when you're driving across an ice pan. It's going to spin over. And of course, when Greece comes out of the euro, which it probably will, all of the CDOs will come, the collateralised debt obligations have been which people have taken out to cover themselves.
This is the derivatives market,
which is 10 times bigger, the shadow banking market, 10 times bigger than the official banking market. Much of it based in the City of London via the Cayman Islands. That will crash. And I don't hear from the Labour front bench any serious analysis of this situation. they are also fiddling while Rome burns, because everybody just wants things to carry on as they are, and it's all going to be all right. And I don't just mean the government in this, it's, there's a general view in society that somehow it will all be sorted out. My historical view would be that it's actually far worse than most people realise, and we've actually got to start talking. If we're going to talk about balancing the books, we've really got to talk about something like a wealth tax or a land tax or something like that, because you can't actually balance the books on the back of poor people. They're the people who spend, they're the people who keep the little shops
going.
But the
wealth tax doesn't produce enough, does it? I'd go with it if it did the job, but you know, and I know, that people like the Greeks, because you're right about what you say in London, they've been getting their money out for ages, and the city of London is doing very, very nicely out of Greece. So don't think they're going to sit back passively when this politician pops up and says we'll have a wealth tax and just pay it over. Life ain't like that, and so I think you've got to be realistic. I've always believed that you've got to look at what I call the real world, and the real world means that all of us, you and I, will have to take some serious pain, and I don't see any alternative to that.
So, what is the millionaires' cabinet that we've got right now?
But
are they going to
so
take?
What?
Are they going to take the pain?
Well, if they do, but so what? You know, you're talking about how many's in the cabinet. You know, that are millionaires.
But they're making decisions which are actually turning out to be very nice for them, and very bad for the most very bad for the most vulnerable in society.
That's your view. I don't accept that they're taking decisions that are bad. And neither does the public, actually. I mean, at this time in a government, in the middle of a crisis, the opinion polls are not as bad as they could be. So I don't think that everybody thinks like that. I think this is beyond the cheap back one way and back the other way politics. I would like, and we haven't got it, a genuine coalition. Because I think that we are in a crisis situation, and I think we need now, as a nation, to look after ourselves, accept that we're going to have to take some pain, and do as much as we can to protect the real vulnerable, because
so
they're
going
to suffer.
Peter, as David Cameron himself got squirreled away in tax havens, because he, when he had the budget, he said that they would take a serious look at being very open about whereabouts individuals in the cabinet's investment were. And Ian Cameron, his father, who he talks about in his speech at the Conservative conference this week, back in the 1980s, was one of the pioneers of tax havens. He actually put his money into the Cayman Islands and.
That?
Back in the 1980s.
But these are political debating points. Do they actually get us anywhere?
Well, possibly.
So there are rich people
possibly.
In this country.
No, all I'm
we
saying
all know
is,
that. There are multi-millionaires in the cabinet. We all know that.
All I'm saying,
who
Peter,
else is going to run the government?
All I'm saying, Peter, is
Miliband a millionaire?
Is it fair to have this money? Is it fair to have this money out of the reach of the taxman in the Cayman Islands and in Panama and places like that?
Of course it's not fair.
So,
of course it's not fair.
So is Cameron going to do anything about it if his money's out there too?
I don't sit down with Dave by the fire and talk about his father's finances. So the only person that can really answer that is his father, I suppose.
Well, he's dead, but he can
is he?
Well, died not long ago.
Yeah,
I'm not laughing because he's dead, but...
Anyway, it has been the Conservative Party conference this week, in case you hadn't noticed, and one of the star performers for many people, certainly from the Conservative point of view, is Boris Johnson. So let's have a listen to Boris and his little talk about mops.
Happy birthday, by the way. Happy birthday, by the way. And I was pleased to see that you've called me a blonde-haired mop in the pages of the... a mop is what I am. Well, if I'm a mop, Dave, then you are a broom. A broom that is cleaning up the mess left by the Labour government, and a fantastic job you are doing. And I thank you, and I congratulate you, and your colleagues, George Osborne, the dustpan, Michael Gove, the J-cloth, William Hague, the sponge... because it is the historic function of Conservative governments over the last 100 years to be the household implements so effective on the floor of the House to clear things up after the Labour binge has got out of control.
Well, one of David Cameron's fellow Bullingdon Club members, Boris Johnson there. And Peter Abraham, you're a Conservative leader in Bristol here. What do you think of the speech that you just heard there from Boris? Because it almost seemed like he upstaged his leader.
I don't think he did. I think he gave us a very entertaining speech. And I've been to many conferences over the years, and it isn't always the leader that gives you the most entertaining speech. I can go back to the 60s, listening to Ian MacLeod, fantastic. Seriousness, and who stole the day, of Enoch Powell. So these things happen. What you have to really ask yourself is, what the media sort of be suggesting, is Boris the leader in waiting? I love Boris. I like him. I think he's talented and he's clever. And I think he's doing a good job in London. But I don't think he's a leader of the country. And I don't think he has that quality. And I think when it comes that David is replaced, I think there could well be other names there that will feature. But Boris does his job, as Michael Heseltine used to, but never actually became the leader, did he? And he was always the darling of conference. So that's a bit of a warning to Boris, because you make him laugh doesn't necessarily mean you get the job.
Well, I mean, I broadly agree with that. I think the real issues are more fundamental than that. That's the sort of things we were talking about earlier. As I say, you mentioned Ian MacLeod there. I wonder, from the 1960s, I wonder whether he or Edward Heath, were they alive today, would be agreeing that cutting public expenditure was what the government should be doing at this moment. And in fact, I'm pretty certain that they'd be saying no. They were from a different generation of Conservatives. And there was a general consensus that this was a bad thing to do as a result of the Keynesian revolution in economic thinking, which influenced the Conservative Party as much as it influenced the Labour Party. And I think as time goes on, this is going to become less of a bone between us and more of an agreed understanding. I mean, the IMF have started to say, look, austerity, and you mentioned earlier investment in infrastructure. Now, therefore, we're starting to talk the same language, even though we've got a difference of emphasis. And I think that's the future, is for us to get serious about, we've got to balance the books in the long run, but cutting public expenditure in the short run, especially on the backs of the poorest, is not a sensible policy.
Martin, what about this whole thing of Peter was implying there that Boris is more of an entertainer than a serious leader of the country?
Well, I think why he's attractive to some elements within the Conservative Party is his actual agenda, if you look at his positions, is pretty radical right. And he's quite presentable, and he's well known as a figure, and people, you know him and like him across the political spectrum. But his actual positions, apart from on the living wage in London, which he's done a good job of forcing through, most of his positions are, you know, basically to the right of the spectrum. I don't think he'd deny that. But I think the Conservative Party, just like the Labour Party, the elections are won in the centre ground. And that's where you've got to
keep your eyes. Is that something you'd agree with, Peter?
Absolutely. I mean, Miliband is adopting the Conservative phrase of one nation. I was making a speech lunchtime today, and I said, as I was having my breakfast this morning, I was looking at the certificate of my grandmother, 1903, as a member of the Primrose League. And it's her badge there as well, which was the Disraeli One Nation. It's a Conservative principle that is got to be. And so I think that mention earlier that I said about real coalition, is this Miliband coming forward and saying that if we're going to be one nation, then some of the rhetoric has got to change, and I welcome the conversion.
It sounds to me like a little bit of a sort of development of this idea, we're all in this together. But of course,
we're not
all this in this together.
We are.
Particularly if some of the most vulnerable, for example, disabled people, are having their benefits withdrawn by a company, Atos, that seems to be really very draconian, and it's kicking something like 9 out of 10 disabled people off of their benefits and really expecting them to appeal. That is not all, we're all in this together, because those people are particularly vulnerable and they're having the help that society provides from them withdrawn.
I think you've got to look at some of the cases, you've got to look at some of the abuses that have taken place over the years. And I think in that, trying to redress the balance, if you like, where we have, I think, got it wrong as far as benefits are concerned, We've allowed people who were capable of work when there genuinely was work out there not to do it. We've had situations where, in certain cases, they were advised that it was better because of their family to be unemployed on benefit because they get more. All those things have got to change. Now, in that course of that change, some people will get hurt, and I'm very distressed about that. And I think that was what I did say earlier, that we've got to look at ways of where we change the benefit system, but we must protect the most vulnerable.
Well, one of the things that has changed is in Scotland, where the company Atos have been told that they will no longer be assessing people. They've been forced into retreat thanks to some campaigning by The Record, which is a Scottish newspaper, and many others in Scotland. The company Atos is no longer going to be doing these assessments up in Scotland. So why is that, Peter, that in Scotland they've decided that they don't want Atos to be doing this anymore, and yet we still have to be putting the disabled people through these campaigns here in England? It seems like there's one law for the north of the border. It's almost like independence has already happened. Yeah.
Yes, but they do control at the local level considerably more than we do. And that seems to me unfair, and I mean, hope that some of the localism will address some of those.
But I mean, they've even had doctors whistleblowing who have been working for Atos saying that they're putting pressure on us to basically just to get people off of benefits whether or not they're able to work. And, you know, the problem with, of course, all of this is there aren't the jobs out there for all these disabled people, as well as the vast pool of unemployed, particularly young unemployed people, that are searching for jobs.
Yes, I mean, I think from a point of view of a mayor for Bristol, I would hope that mayor would top priority would be jobs for young people. I think it really worries me that we're not producing the jobs in the way that we should. Things are getting better, and every day we're 140 new apprenticeships are being found in the country. But it's still not enough. I mean, when I left school at 15, I went straight into an apprenticeship. I didn't think I would have a day on it. I laugh about it, but I had a gap weekend. I left school on Friday and started work on Monday morning, and have worked ever since.
And I think there's a lot of young people who would love to feel that today. You know, why is it
gone?
We can't?
They're getting good degrees, they're getting this, and now they're finding... I was talking to somebody who's got a grade A student who's been 2 years unemployed. That is tragic, and now that person is becoming not looking in the way that they should for a job, and that is one of the difficulties. So we've got to look at new ways of tackling this.
Martin, you know, you're an economist, you studied at Oxford. Give us the answer, because we want to know how to turn the economy round to make sure that when people come out of university, they can get a job as soon as possible, straight away.
Well, I mean, the economy was run at full employment by both Conservative and Labour governments for many years by using demand management techniques. And, of course, in the 70s, with the changes in the global economy, that no longer became possible or even desired. I mean, effectively, there was a decision made by the people at the top that they were going to run it with at least 1 million unemployed in order to basically undercut the unions, basically create a situation where wages would be suppressed, which then of course boosted profits and therefore created an asset bubble, which then led to a crash and all the rest of it. I think in the medium term, the Greens have been talking about this for some time. Of course, you won't hear this from the Labour front bench. We have to move towards what is called a citizen's income, and Ian Duncan Smith's universal credit is halfway there. A citizen's income was originally thought of by Milton Friedman, who was a right-wing economist, Chicago School, and he called it negative income tax. And basically, when you've reached a certain level of productivity in an economy, which we have now with the internet and all the rest of it, computers and so on, you've got a problem with structural unemployment. People, there basically ain't enough jobs to go round. So what you do is you make everybody, you ensure that everybody has a basic income. So, you know, if you're 16 years old, you get a basic income.
But it sounds to me what you're saying is that you're giving up on full employment.
Yes, because I don't see us going back to a full employment society to produce more and more stuff, which we don't really want. What we want is a society where we produce enough stuff, and we give what we're really looking for is people have the time to raise their families properly and so on. You know, you talk about people with big families. You've got single mums, for example. actually a single mum looking after their children is doing a job for society. And we ought to recognise that.
Peter, what are your thoughts about this idea of a basic income? Because there has been a change, hasn't there, over the last 50 years, when Britain used to make things. Nowadays, we import much of our stuff from places like China.
I'd love to live in a nation where a basic income was there, because I think that everybody has the right to certain basic needs and facilities. But what I'm worried about is this... jobs that people will not necessarily want or have jobs. It's no secret, I'm 73, and although I don't do paid employment in quite the same way as I used to, I am working probably more hours every week than the average worker in this country. I have very few days off, very few nights off, and I love it. And I want to work, and I want to do these things. I do some work in the local government association, so I go around the country helping other local authorities. So I'm really genuinely working. Now, I don't... That is nothing to do with money. I need money, of course I do, but it's nothing to do with that. And I think that people out there need to be satisfied with a proper job, and their families need it. You know, parents are better if they've got jobs, they've got respect, and they've got knowledge that employment gives you. So I think we've got to rethink in this age what employment, what it all means. And it might well be that we've got to look, and I've really believe that we should be looking at the community groups and all that who could do so much. You know, when you hear, and a friend of mine is going through a bad patch at the moment because of illness, and they get a visit once a day, a really satisfying job of going in and looking after that person could be there, and surely that would be well spent as society, wouldn't it? You know, as money to help. So there's loads of things that need to be done.
Martin, I wonder whether, you know, the government, as sort of the Treasury, I suppose I'm saying here, has let it slip with finances. You know, the city is a very powerful organisation in itself. It lobbies. It uses a lot of the money that it's got from the bailout also to lobby for its own power. I mean, shouldn't we be in a situation where the government can simply... rather than putting a hand out to the banks and saying, please, we need some more and borrowing, why can't the government actually start intervening in the economy? And, I mean, as the Bank of England has been doing, they're printing money, but they're not actually spending it in the economy. They're giving it to the banks, who then are failing to actually allow it. It's almost like a kind of airlock between the quantitative easing money that's being produced by the Bank of England, and it's not getting through into the economy. So how do we get through that?
Well, I think the fundamental problem, the genuine free marketeers... And I genuinely, I mean, and Ron Paul, for example, would represent this.
He's a Republican. He was a Republican candidate in the US.
Was a Republican, and he, you know, he fought a good campaign from his own point of view. He wasn't selected as the candidate through various methods that kept him out. But I mean, the point is that the reason why we've got all these fiscal problems in the US, Britain, and elsewhere is because we rescued the banking system in 2008. Now, you could argue at the time. I supported that because I thought once the banking system has been rescued by the government, we're going to get back to some reality here, and we're not going to be talking about the free market anymore. We're going to be talking about a mixed economy with the government. If the government's going to have to intervene to prop up the financial markets, surely the penny will drop that they can't just be allowed to do what they want. The government's got to have a bigger role and so on. But what happened was, having been bailed out, the political power... And Milton Friedman predicted this: when you bail out a failing industry, you then have to carry on bailing them out. It becomes a black hole. And, you know, people used to think of the car industry in Britain as a black hole. I tell you, there's a massive black hole in our finances, and it's in the City of London. And I've seen studies which suggest that any money we've got out of them as tax, we've paid back in as subsidy. In other words, the whole of the City of London is like a great big clapped-out mine in Wales, and maybe we should just close it down. And, of course, that is radical free market thinking. That's the business.
That's
Peter,
scary.
Are you a free,
it is scary,
are you a,
but it's the business.
Are you, are you that much of a free marketeer, Peter,
I'm
that you
no,
would
no,
allow
no.
these
Nor
banks?
Am I, but no. I think that is the free market policy.
Because yes. There is this argument that the banks were too big to fail.
Yes. I really think that we've got to look realistically. It's back to my the real world again. what we've got to do is, here in Bristol, we've got great opportunities, lovely city to live in. I think we need to attract new jobs, new opportunities, particularly for young people. I would like to see encouragement from the government to do that, not by just, and I'll be critical of them, coming out and saying that you can build an extra porch on your house or a single-storey extension. It's got to be bigger than that, and it's got to have some long-term benefit to the society in Bristol, whether it be jobs or the type of facilities that we need. And I would like to see us going on in doing that. And that can be done by perhaps national insurance holidays, because what is that, 12% now? Quite a lot of money to employ somebody, particularly if you're starting off. And genuine starter things for companies who are going to really create new jobs.
Well, let's have a listen to David Cameron. We heard from Boris earlier on, and the end of his speech to the Conservative Party conference, and he talks about Ian Cameron. Now, we were talking about earlier on his father, and how he inspired him as a young man.
My dad influenced me much more than I ever thought. He was born with no heels on his feet, with legs that were about a foot shorter than they were meant to be. But he never complained, even when he lost those legs later in his life. Because disability in the 1930s was such a stigma, he was an only child, probably a lonely child. But my dad was the eternal optimist. To him, the glass was always half full, usually with something fairly alcoholic in it. And when I was a boy, I remember once going for a long walk with him in the village where we lived, and we walked past the church he supported all his life and past the village hall where he took part in unbelievably long parish council meetings. And he told me what he was most proud of. And it was simple. It was working hard from the moment he left school and providing a good start in life for his family. Not just all of us, but helping his mum too when his father ran off. Not a hard luck story, but a hard work story. Work hard. Family comes first, but put back into the community too. There's nothing complicated about me. I believe in working hard, caring for my family, serving my country. And there's nothing complicated about what we need today. This is still the greatest country on earth. We showed that again this summer, 22nd in world population, 3rd in the medals table. But it's tough. These are difficult times. We're being tested. How will we come through it? Again, it's not complicated. Hard work, strong families, taking responsibility, serving others. As I said on the steps of number 10 Downing Street before walking through that door, those who can should, those who can't we will always help. The job of this party, of this government, is to help bring out the best in this country, because at our best we are unbeatable. We know Britain can deliver because we've seen it time and time again. This is the country that invented the computer, defeated the Nazis, started the web, saw off the slave trade, unraveled DNA, fought off every invader for 1,000 years. We even persuaded the Queen to jump out of a helicopter to make the world smile. There's nothing we can't do. Can we make Britain the best place in the world to start a business, to grow a business, to help that business take on the world and win? Yes. Can we, the people who invented the welfare state in the first place, turn it into something that rewards efforts, that helps keep families together, that really helps the poorest with a new start in life? Yes. And can we take those schools and turn out students that will take on the brightest in the world? Yes, of course we can. Let us here in this hall, here in this government, together in this country, make this pledge. Let us build an aspiration nation. Let us get Britain on the rise. Deficit paid down, tough decisions taken, growth fired up, aspiration backed all the way. We know what it takes to win in the tough world of today, to win for all our people, to win for Britain. So let us get out there and do it.
David Cameron speaking at the Conservative Party conference this week. Martin, I'll ask you about this one first. I mean, it's a bit of a buzz, that these speeches, but how much content is there really in there?
Well, the most significant content from my point of view is where he said we invented the welfare state. In fact, we didn't. I think the New Zealanders beat us, and so did the Swedes, but that's another issue.
Also, he said we beat the Nazis. Actually, the Russians did.
Well, that's another... I mean, but I think that is code. I mean, it's like criminology. That's code. He's actually communicating to his party that the welfare state is not something that they can imagine that they're going to get rid of, and that is to be welcomed. Because, of course, what you need in a time of crisis like this, you need a welfare state. You really do. That's why the welfare state was invented. And as the economy crashes, as it may well do if the euro unravels, we are going to need unemployment benefits, because that's what will protect us from the economy going right down the drain. The welfare state is not just fair and reasonable, it's also an essential part of a modern capitalist economy, because otherwise you sink.
Peter Abrahams, Conservative leader in Bristol City Council, he was saying there that we're being tested. Do you think David Cameron is the man to rise to that challenge and also to lead the party into the next general election?
Almost certainly. I think there were a number of key points there for me, but the major one is more or less sums up the last 55 minutes and perhaps where we might disagree. Is I think the key has to be to reward efforts. People will wish to be rewarded for what they do, and therefore I think we've got to look at the welfare state. We've got to make sure that those that are able to work have the talent to create jobs. And you know, I was an employer for years, and I felt very proud when I would see my list of employees. They were like my family, that I was able to, when their wives came in with their children, to see that that's something I started, was being rewarded in that way. So I think that you must look to give people opportunity. And what I'm sad about is that I think sometimes I look there and think those opportunities are not being taken.
What about you mean, you're talking about being rewarded for your efforts. There's a lot of low-paid people who are working very hard who are looking at the Conservative coalition, Lib Dem coalition now, and saying, well, what are you doing with the energy companies? What are you doing with the people that run our food supply? We've had both of these two things. Energy, that is to say British Gas, raising its gas and electricity prices today, has been announced by 6% or yesterday, rising food prices and this fear of a hunger epidemic. So these people are working very hard, and yet they're finding that their disposable income is going into negative figures.
Absolutely. And that seems to me that one of the things, if you are going to be an employer, then I think you have a duty to pay, I was going to say the appropriate, But it might be that you have a duty to pay a proper, genuine living wage. I think that's part of the responsibility. And if you can't create that job and be able to pay, then I don't think probably you should do it. You ought to be looking elsewhere. So I think there are ways. But energy, I think we do need, don't we, as a government, as a country, to get to grips with these companies, because I just don't understand it. And again, if you're the brighter side, the richer, you can take all these measures of saving £200 a year by loft extensions and all the rest of it. But if you're on benefit, that's a very, very difficult thing to face to do. So I think we need to. Today I heard, and I hadn't realised this, for every pint of milk, the supermarket gets 16p. That seems to me to be... people are taking advantage. And I think we do need to step in and regulate and say that enough is enough, and we must bring in some new regimes that do respect people to be rewarded for their efforts, but are responsible in that reward.
But aren't the Conservatives a party of economic determinism, so that money drives these things? I mean, what we're seeing around the city is pubs closing and being turned into Tesco Expresses. Is that what people want?
It appears they do, because they use them. It's sad. I mean, I've been a local retailer. That was my job, if you like. And so Mr. Tesco in the Big Is would have upset me. But it's what people want, and they must be determined on that. But I think it's bigger than that. I really do. And I think we've got to say, I don't think we can go on saying the conservative philosophy is this. I think that one of the things, I was talking to somebody this morning who was at the Conservative Party conference this week, and were surprised how many young people were there. Now, that is good news, because I think young people's conservatism is going to be different, and I applaud that.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this particular angle on things?
Which particular angle are we talking about?
Well, I mean, what we're discussing here is the business of whether these things should be just economically driven, like Peter was talking about that particular little example was whether these things should be financially driven or whether they should be regulated.
I think traditionally the Conservative Party was very clear that it wasn't a free market party, not 100%, absolutely not. And that was actually very much a part of the Conservative self-image in years gone by. I remember it was Edward Heath who put the phrase together, the unacceptable face of capitalism, talking about what the city had been up to in the 70s, which of course was very, very mild compared to all the sort of things they've got up subsequently. And when Edward Heath went to talk to the Russians after they had the changes in Russia and he met with Gorbachev, he said, don't go too fast on liberalising your economy. We went quite slow in the 1940s and we didn't rush at it. And so he was actually, because of the experience of that generation of the free market crashing in the 20s and the 30s and then the war, the conservatism in this country certainly did not have a super free market edge to it.
Okay, well,
there's been a whole generational change, so where even the new Labour people now would be to the right of some of the conservatives of the 1950s.
Absolutely right.
Okay, one of the supposed great things about the free market is these big franchise bids, and we had a bit of a disaster last week with the government Department of Transport overturning First Group's bid for the West Coast Main Line, and that was featured in the House of Commons this week. Actually, no, in the House of Lords, because the Commons was closed. I think it was Wednesday. So let's have a listen to that discussion. This is Keith McDougall from the Radio 4 programme Today in Parliament.
Liberal Democrats railway expert Lord Bradshaw believed the crisis over the West Coast Main Line meant there was now a doubt over all train franchising, so new legislation was needed.
The franchise process is probably irretrievably broken. Would he ask his noble friend, the Secretary of State, to actually make room in the legislative programme for the next session of Parliament, because I believe it is inevitable that this Act and its successors will have to be reviewed.
Lord Attlee said he didn't agree that the whole franchise system was broken. That was the subject of the second inquiry the government had set up, at which point he believed peers could benefit from the thoughts of a transport expert.
Professor David Begg has been reported in the Financial Times as saying, because of this procurement failure, we risk becoming far too negative and throwing out the baby with the bathwater. We can fix this, we've done it before. Wise words indeed, and the first and correct step is these two fairly quick inquiries.
Lord Adonis, who was the Transport Secretary in Gordon Brown's government, questioned the decision to quote Professor Begg.
Is the noble earl aware that Professor David Begg is a non-executive director of First Group, the company to which his department awarded the franchise before it had to be cancelled, and that therefore he is not an entirely independent observer of these events?
Lord Adonis said he had respect for Sam Laidlaw, but wondered how he could be considered independent. He served on the Transport Department Board, which was made up of the people whose actions he was inquiring into.
Does the noble earl not recognise that the findings of such an inquiry will always be tainted until they are properly independently conducted, and that proper independent review cannot take place under a non-executive director of the very department which has conducted probably the single biggest failure in British public policy since the poll tax?
Well, it seems that Richard Branson and his Virgin Group were probably right, Peter, to question this awarding of this franchise to First Group. I mean, one wonders if you could turn the clock back whether they should have the West Coast main line, and also this the I suppose it's West Country line, the line to here in Bristol as well.
I'm not sure that we know that Richard Branson was right. I thought that the department had got some of their figures wrong, but it wasn't in the area where Richard Branson was complaining about. I'm going to wait to see what the inquiry says. I don't think the franchise system is broken. I think there were some failures in the procurement, and I think that was and I also think that the scrutiny of these contracts was not as good as it could have been.
Martin, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I think the fact is that we're now spending three times more on subsidising the railways than we were under nationalisation, and yet some people are making profits on it. In New Zealand, the Labour government privatised the railways, and then a more radical Labour government renationalised them. You've got a Conservative government now in New Zealand, the railways are still in public ownership. That's Southern Hemisphere right.
Okay,
there.
Our final story. Have your say on a new local council tax support scheme. There's still time for you to have your say on the council's consultation on a new local council tax support scheme. Bristol residents are being asked to give their views on changes to the way they're helped with paying council tax is provided to these those on low incomes. Martin, this is it means effectively that different councils right across the country are going to have different ways of dealing with council tax. And again, Peter, this is a bit of a problem because these are people basically that cannot afford to pay council tax are now being told, well, you're going to have to pay anyway, even though you haven't got the money.
I'm not sure that is the case. What we have to do, and it is a consultation at the moment, is how best the rate support scheme can be administered. The problem to us as a city, it seems to me, is we have to reduce the money that we're spending on it. It's getting out of hand, and I understand that if we were to go on at the rate we're going on, that it would be just such an incredible amount that we wouldn't be able to
afford
it.
Before we had all the poll tax riots and things like that, this money would have been paid by the landowner, by the buy-to-let landowner, by the person who owned the house, the person that's got the money to pay, not by the person who's, you know, impoverished with fuel bills and low pay. I mean, it just seems completely unfair.
I don't see it in that way. And I must say, you say the poll tax, that was the community charge,
but that
which
was
I think when it
resident.
Was done away with was actually beginning to work quite well.
But it was levying it on the resident rather than the owner. Martin, your thoughts finally, we're just coming up to the end of the hour.
Well, I think the rates existed from the time of Elizabeth I, and the property classes always complained about the rates, but the rates were a very effective way of raising local revenue, and I'm afraid that council tax just doesn't cut the mustard. And of course we're now going to have a situation where each council will have its own council tax collection policy, which undercuts the in Duncan Smith's universal credit.
Martin, Martin, that's it. Coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock, thanks to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for Stoke Bishop and leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Peter Abraham. After the news, Big Brother watching.
Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.